It's The Takeaway. I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, who returns on Monday. Thank you so much for joining us. Most of us have been following stay-at-home orders for weeks now, and, well, it is starting to take a toll. As the weather warms up and people increasingly feel the mental and emotional strain of isolation, quarantine fatigue is a part of our new reality. And the need for social connection with friends and family is becoming increasingly important. We asked you, our listeners, how quarantine fatigue is affecting you.
This is Michelle from Dallas, Texas. I am absolutely feeling quarantine fatigue. I don't know what information to trust, what's safe, where I can go, and what I can do. I have met with some small groups of friends that I know where they've been and what they've been up to pretty much, worn masks whenever I go out, and hope that we're taking all the right precautions, keep washing my hands. The best we can do is try to do the best for each other and hope that it works out.
I'm Richard Bell. I'm calling from Little Rock, Arkansas. The way I'm dealing with quarantine fatigue is that I sit in my garage looking out at all the traffic going up and down the street. And I try to get out here every day for at least an hour just to take in the fresh air, look at the birds, and contemplate what the new normal will be.
This is Nancy from Berkeley, and I am definitely feeling quarantine fatigue. Fortunately, I live in a nice area with nice weather and nice places to hike. So I've been doing two things. One is I've never gotten so much use out of my backyard, which is big enough to meet with one or two friends at a time and sit at a distance. And the other is going distance birding with a couple of friends. We stay 6 feet apart. We pick wide trails and we get up into the hills and out into nature.
Hi, Rich from San Jose, California. We are spending a little time with some friends. Most of our friends feel the same way about the coronavirus, taking it seriously. Not getting too crazy about it, but definitely taking it seriously. We've had some friends over to the house for a pool party, but, you know, only a handful of people. Just trying to be conscientious of the potential downfalls. Other than that, you know, just trying to live life as normally as possible.
Hi, this is Andrea from Riverdale, New York. For the first 6 weeks, we did not meet up with other people, but about 2 weeks ago, we had friends over in our backyard. They were about 10 feet away from us, and they were sitting on a blanket, and we were sitting on a table, and it was just so wonderful to be able to spend time with people that we care about.
This quarantine is getting old, but I'm not giving up the scientist guidelines. Now that I've got 9 masks and plenty of toilet paper, I'm okay. Plus, I just found out what my real hair color is. This is Barbara in San Jose.
Hi, this is Kristen from Ridgewood, New York. I'm having a really hard time with quarantine fatigue and wanting to open our circle up to grandparents to see our kids. But I'm feeling so guilty on both sides, and I feel guilty if grandparents don't get to see the kids enough and I'm missing them, and I'm also feeling horrible if we were to ever get anyone in our family sick.
It's something just about everyone is grappling with right now. For more on navigating the risks of seeing friends and family, I spoke with Julia Marcus, an infectious disease epidemiologist and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. She recently wrote a piece published in The Atlantic on quarantine fatigue. And Christina Cotterucci, a writer for Slate magazine. She's written about her decision to form a quarantine bubble with people outside of her household. And Julia says it's no surprise that this fatigue is setting in now.
In early March, when we started this whole staying at home thing, we had all kind of hoped that it would be a few weeks and then we'd be back to our lives as they were before COVID came along. But now we're several months into this, and it's become very clear that while we really needed to be staying home for those few months, and it had an enormous impact that was really necessary, we're now going to have to keep doing some amount of social distancing for months, if not years. And so I think now is the time to start thinking about how to do this in a sustainable way.
Yeah, and you argue that this sort of all or nothing approach to quarantine might not really be ideal.
That's right. If we think about this with the analogy of abstinence-only messaging, what we're being asked to abstain from right now is social contact. And I think that's doable for many people for a short period of time, but I think we can also all agree that it's not feasible for people to sustain no social contact for a really extended period of time. And sometimes there are inadvertent consequences of abstinence-only messaging. And we see that in the context of, let's say, telling teens not to have any sex. Some ultimately will. And if we don't give them strategies to reduce risk if they do choose to have sex, then we've missed an opportunity. And that's why we sometimes see worse health outcomes with abstinence-only messaging. And the same may happen here.
So, Christina, you wrote about how you decided to form a quarantine bubble with some of your friends who aren't in the same household. Tell us how the bubble works and what are the rules?
So the general concept of forming a quarantine bubble is very similar to the idea of just expanding your household to include more people. So it's a closed circle of people. In my bubble, it's three different households of two people each. And we've all agreed that we're going to have contact with each other, go to each other's houses, interact as closely as we would with a family member, but not have interactions with people outside the house. So essentially, we've expanded our quarantine unit to be slightly larger. And for me, the impetus was just that I was feeling incredibly isolated. You know, my wife and I don't live in a big house. We don't have a backyard. And like a lot of people, you know, we were feeling really lonely, cut off from our community, which is really important to us. And we decided that the risk of increasing our family unit by four other people would be marginal if we limited our contact outside of that bubble. So over the course of a couple weeks, we had discussions with these two other households of friends of ours and decided we're all going to take extremely conservative precautions outside of our bubble, you know, wearing masks, not seeing anybody else at a distance closer than 6 to 10 feet. But with each other, you know, we'll interact as we would inside our own household. So having dinners together, hanging out together, and has given us a little bit of a sense of normalcy in this incredibly abnormal time.
Julia, Christina there is talking about sort of assessing the risks involved. And it seems there could be a trade-off here between the mental health costs of staying isolated and the public health costs of going outside or meeting up with friends and family. How can people navigate that balance in a responsible way?
I think what we want to do is help people see these options, like what Christina is describing, where you expand your bubble to include another household and you do it very carefully and with a lot of good communication around risk. That's a lower risk option for social contact than, you know, what we may have done previously, which is, let's say, have multiple dinner parties a week with different families. That becomes much higher risk. And if there is a real need for social contact, like what Christina just described, then that strategy of the double bubble, which is what some Canadian provinces and New Zealand are calling it, becomes a harm reduction strategy where it accepts that, okay, somebody might need to have social contact and here's a lower risk way to do it than a situation like a crowded house party that could potentially become a super spreader event. That's really what we want to avoid. So it's not zero risk because, you know, every new social contact is going to increase risk, but it's definitely lower risk than some other alternatives that people may be considering right now.
And I'm glad that you mentioned the concept of harm reduction, Julia, because I've also been thinking about what happens if our quarantine has to last for 12 to 18 more months or there's another spike in coronavirus cases and we have to lock down again. For me, having my own plan for limited social contact that is really sustainable, I mean, I do feel like my social needs are being met right now in a limited way. I find myself way less likely to want to go out and have a spontaneous dinner party with other friends, or I feel less of a need to go out to a restaurant or a movie theater or any of these places that I might have been longing for if I was just trapped in my own apartment with one other person for months at a time.
I know a lot of people are talking about, even just with their partner at home, the need for socialization and really the need for their friends. And Christina, you wrote about how your quarantine bubble is made up of all queer friends, really your chosen family, and that queer people maybe understand best this need to look beyond your immediate family for support. So tell us more about that.
I think the concept of chosen family is a really natural and organic one for a lot of us. You know, whether it be because we are estranged from our families of birth, or just because we create community wherever we are. So we develop very close, you know, family-like relationships with people in our queer communities. We're also all very familiar with conversations that people have around non-monogamous relationships, around harm reduction and sex. We're all familiar with the history of HIV and AIDS. So the conversations that we have had around, you know, our tolerance for risk within our quarantine bubble, and generally trust, have felt very queer and very familiar to a lot of us from different areas of our lives. And in some ways, you know, I think those family-like relationships that we already have formed the basis of trust that made me feel comfortable joining a quarantine bubble. You know, as I've talked to other friends and coworkers about this, some people have said things like, well, you know, how do you trust that no one's going to pop the bubble and have a secret hangout with a friend or invite them over to their house? And I mean, I completely trust these people. I wouldn't have entered a bubble if I didn't feel that we were all sort of mutually committed to one another in this moment, and in a very important way, you know, when we're trying to prevent the spread of this virus that we know very little about.
Julia, I feel like I've been seeing on social media videos of people breaking social distancing rules. Maybe they're partying together or just large throngs of people in public spaces together. And I've been seeing a lot of kind of shaming happening on social media, but you say that shaming doesn't actually work in situations like this. Why not?
Well, I'm coming at this as an HIV prevention researcher, and we know that when we shame people for engaging in behavior that might increase their risk of HIV, let's say having condomless sex, then that behavior becomes stigmatized and people are afraid to disclose it. It doesn't actually stop the behavior. What it does is it pushes people away from disclosing that behavior, let's say, to a healthcare provider. And the result is that people don't end up getting the healthcare that they need. And you can imagine how that would play out right now. For example, we may shame people for gathering in a park, having a picnic, not wearing masks. And if we call them out on social media, they next time may not have that picnic, and instead they may take that socializing indoors where it actually becomes higher risk. And then you can also imagine that if there's an outbreak in that situation and contact tracers are trying to locate all the people who attended the event, those people may be hesitant to disclose that they were there. And essentially, shaming in the end doesn't have the effect that we want it to. It doesn't make the behavior go away. It drives it underground and it drives people away from accessing the public health services that they need.
I feel like we're talking a lot about balancing and assessing risks, but for some people, there are structural factors like systemic racism or poverty that take that decision-making around the risks completely out of your hands. Julia, how do you think public health officials could take that into account in their guidelines?
Considering context is a really important part of harm reduction. And one of the ways that it can help is that when we think about the context in which people make decisions about, let's say, social distancing, then we start to remember that they may not have total control over their situation. There may be context like depression because of isolation, but as you pointed out, there may also be structural factors like systemic racism that make it very difficult to social distance. And that's why people have been talking about social distancing being a privilege. We can also think about scenarios like the story of the hairdresser that was shared a couple days ago, who continued to work despite public health guidelines and ended up being linked to many new cases. And in that scenario, that hairdresser was shamed, but as an individual, he was making a decision in the context of needing a paycheck and not having enough social support or resources from the government to allow him to stay home and stop working. Mm-hmm. And when we blame that individual, we distract from where the accountability really lies, which is on the institutions that failed to support him. So when we come at this from a harm reduction approach, we keep that context front and center to avoid blaming the individual and also to remember where resources are actually needed.
You know, I'll be honest, I've been personally having a kind of hard time thinking about when I might be able to see my grandmothers again. They both live in different countries, different from each other as well. And I'm sure that many others are in a similar situation with older family members who live more than a car ride away. Julia, how can you navigate the risks when thinking about trying to see your family members who live far away?
I mean, certainly for somebody who is more local, we can think about low-risk ways to have a visit that might include being outdoors and remaining physically distant, mm-hmm. not sharing food, wearing masks. But then when you're talking about flying to see somebody, it becomes more complicated. I think in that scenario, ways to reduce risk would be to quarantine yourself for 2 weeks on either side of the trip and have the family that you're visiting do the same, and to be as careful as possible on the actual trip in terms of potential exposure at the airport or on the airplane.
Christina, has this come up in your quarantine bubble? Anyone wanting to visit others, especially elderly family members? I think that's when it really comes into play, wanting to break a rule or do it responsibly.
Yeah, we actually do have one couple in our bubble who are planning a visit to an older family member out in California. And in some ways, the fact that we have a bubble is making it a lot easier to plan a trip like that. You know, my wife and I are going to care for their dog. We're able to drive them to the airport so they don't have to take a Lyft or public transportation. And then we're starting conversations about what happens when they return from that trip. You know, will mm-hmm. they quarantine from our bubble? Will the rest of us see them, but you know, thoroughly limit our contact with the outside world even more than we're doing right now? But, you know, it helps to have other people to discuss those things with. You know, it's more people who can be doing research. It's more opinions and support that we can share with one another. But yeah, those questions aren't easy for anyone.
What about for people with children? I feel like I've been hearing from a lot of my parent friends that they are just wishing and dying to set up play dates for their kids, but they want to think about how to do that responsibly. Is there a way to consider it responsibly?
As a mom of two little kids who are 3 and 6, this is definitely at the front of my mind as well. Mm-hmm. I think with older kids, it's a bit easier because they may have an ability to understand that's 6 feet of distance. And I found that our kids really adapted very quickly to that norm. And now they police us. If we stand too close to someone, they say, "Mama, that's, you know, less than 6 feet." So I think it is possible to think about ways that you could maybe meet up in a park and have your kids kick a soccer ball around or go on a bike ride with another kid and a couple parents. And then another approach would be the one that Christina's taking, where you find another family that has kids the same age and decide to, you know, be a quarantine together. And those kids can then play together without that need for physical distancing. And again, mm-hmm. it's not zero risk, but it is lower risk than, you know, your kids having a play date with different kids every few days.
And what about in general? I mean, what types of activities would you advise listeners to consider that could be low risk and could definitely satisfy that sense of socialization that people are missing?
I think the key here, at least for these next few months, is going to be being outdoors and keeping social interactions outdoors as much as possible. And of course, that's easier in some places that have more outdoor space than others, like really dense cities. But as much as you know, cities can be thinking about opening up more outdoor space for people, I think that will help. And you know, activities like walking with somebody, biking with someone, going on a run with someone, those are very low risk activities that can give people enough social contact that they feel sustained. And if people do want to get together in a group, try to keep that outdoors and try to maintain distance and try not to share food. Those are kind of, and of course, masks. All these same messages that we've been hearing for the last couple months still hold. But I think we have a better understanding now that transmission risk is much lower outdoors than it is indoors. And so that can help us think about ways that we can get some of that social contact, at least while the weather is pretty good over these next few months.
Christina, any last advice for people who might be listening and thinking, that sounds like a good idea. Maybe I should form my own quarantine bubble.
I would just say it's important to take into consideration what your lives are like before committing to a pod. I mean, we're all very lucky in that we have jobs that allow us to work from home. We don't have to take public transit to go to each other's houses. And none of us have any, you know, indoor interaction with people who aren't in our pod. I know not everybody has that ability, which can make it hard if you have a group of friends with different jobs that require them to be working with a person in a very vulnerable community who might be at risk for extra complications from coronavirus. I also think it's important to have honest conversations about your own understanding of the risks of being in a pod and in your activities outside the pod. You know, if we weren't all sort of on the same page in our desire to take very conservative precautions outside the pod, I don't think any of us would have wanted to commit to an exclusive household relationship with the others. But one of the best parts about it, if you are able to make it work, is the occasional ability to forget that the pandemic exists. The only time that I've really been able to do that has been when I've been, you know, in somebody else's house, interacting with other people in a way that I otherwise haven't been able to for months now. And I can't overstate the psychic relief that I've gotten from that.
Julia Marcus is an infectious disease epidemiologist and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. And Christina Cotterucci is a writer for Slate Magazine. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.